Welcome to Keeping It Civil, a podcast co-sponsored by the School of Civic and Economic Thought and Leadership at Arizona State University and Arizona PBS. I'm Henry Thompson, a professor in the School of Politics and Global Studies at Arizona State University. This is an interview show in which I talk to scholars, writers, intellectuals, and thought leaders about civil discourse, the American political tradition, and intellectual life more broadly. I hope you enjoy the conversation.
King drew from Douglass's own appreciation of the land of his birth. The things that he appreciated in America were precisely the things that pointed out where America was falling short in terms of its practice. Contrary to King, Douglass thought America was sufficient in terms of its principles, founding principles, the ones right at the beginning.
On this episode, I spoke to Lucas Morrell, professor of politics at Washington and Lee University. We talked about Martin Luther King, Frederick Douglass, and their contrasting modes of American patriotism. We also talked about his work on the commission celebrating the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Lucas Morrell, thank you very much for being on the podcast and welcome to Keeping It Civil.
Glad to be here.
Last week you were out here in Tempe to give the Martin Luther King Day lecture at ASU, and I just wanted to ask you a little bit about that. What was your main message for the audience in the lecture to commemorate Martin Luther King Day?
Yeah, my main message was really to think about patriotism, which I define simply as love of one's country, and to think about patriotism in light of two great American patriots, Martin Luther King Jr., given the Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and Frederick Douglass, both of them, given that they are Black Americans and had obvious reasons not to like America, but both came around to appreciating what this country had to offer and what it was about America that could lead to greater progress in civil and political rights. But I would argue that in King's case, later in life, he came to have some serious reservations about all that he expected of America, but did not believe what America was offering was sufficient to provide that. So it was a bit of using Douglass to critique King, if you will.
So you're saying that towards the end of his life, Martin Luther King came to have more doubts about his love for his own country?
Yeah, and I would put it this way. It's not that he no longer loved America, but he did not believe that what America had to offer in terms of its political principles and its political institutions was sufficient to create what he referred to as the beloved community. And so he became very discouraged, aired that discouragement in two particular books that he published in 64 and in 67. And in those books, he outlines the ways in which he thinks America needed to do more, but needed some significant changes in order to produce ultimately the American dream for everybody.
What was this beloved community that he was aspiring to? How did he define that?
The beloved community for him was a community not simply where men and women of all races simply coexisted or tolerated one another, but where they actually loved one another. And his understanding of love comes, as you might imagine, given that he was a Baptist Christian minister, came from the Bible. The New Testament uses a Greek word called agape. And in the Greek, there are several terms used to define love. But agape is the sort of love, the concern that you have and actions towards others that you do simply because they're made in the image of God and not because you think you're going to get something out of it. And so he thought that a community of love, again, across color barriers and all sorts of barriers, he thought that that community was the ultimate goal or should be the ultimate goal of the civil rights movement. And it's not simply changes in laws, but changes in heart.
Would you say that this beloved community is something that he always aspired to, and he became increasingly pessimistic about America's ability to live up to it? Or did he start out with different expectations for American public life, American society, and adjust his expectations as time went on?
I'm not sure how different those two ways of presenting it are. For the longest time, he was a proponent of what he called the beloved community. He had a dream that was deeply rooted in the American dream. And so it may not have been identical with the American dream, but it was a dream, as he put it most famously in August 1963, on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. His dream was a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. And so what he had argued up until about 1964 was that his dream was something that could be more or less accomplished by reinforcing the principles and institutions that majority white America at least claimed to believe in, principles from the Declaration of Independence, you know, all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, government by consent of the governed. These principles, if America lived up to them, as he put it many times, he says, all we ask is that you be true to what you said on paper. If that happened, and because whites were the majority of this country, and at a certain point in time, of course, tragically had enslaved the most of their black population, he thought if whites at least lived up to their professions, he thought that that dream could be a reality for everyone. But in 1964 and 65, with the passage of landmark legislation, the Civil Rights Act, and in 65, the Voting Rights Act, he believed that the results or the product of those federal laws wasn't bringing progress fast enough for Black Americans. And therefore, he thought we needed a radical restructuring of what he called the whole of American society. This is what he said in 1967. And he also said that we needed a new set of values. I'm quoting him verbatim. So a new set of values, but he did not explain or outline what those values were. And he even conceded that the Constitution was not clear or perhaps not even equipped to bring about that change of heart in white American society to enable that new set of values to be instantiated and his dream to become a reality. And so he was grasping or aspiring for something that he was unclear how he was going to get there, certainly unclear in terms of, for example, any amendments to the Constitution. He was clear in this respect. He did have two specific policies that he thought needed to be passed by Congress. It had to be federal action. One was what he called a Bill of Rights for the Disadvantaged that would principally help Black Americans, but would also help poor white Americans who he believed were the kind of collateral damage of our long history of enslavement of Black people and segregation of Black people. He thought that a federal program would have an immediate impact on the psyches, especially of Black men, Black males, that if that program of federal assistance were to occur on a wide scale, he thought that that would create incentives for Black men to pursue an education, job training, et cetera, and be able to provide for themselves and their families. Related to that, he also argued for what he called a guaranteed national income. I think what goes by UBI today, universal basic income, essentially a floor below which no person on American soil should fall. He thought if we had that safety net economically, he believed that would embolden especially Black Americans to improve their lot in life.
Yeah, I think that's extremely interesting because, of course, this era of the 1960s is also an era of expansion of the American welfare state, the Great Society programs, and those sorts of things. So was Martin Luther King sort of not supportive of those programs or didn't think they went far enough, or what was his critique there?
I think that they did not go far enough. You're right that Kennedy and Presidents Kennedy and Johnson, drawing from the precedent set in during the New Deal under FDR, they had led Congress in producing what you mentioned was the Great Society federal assistance programs. One of them was a fairly old one called Aid to Family with Dependent Children, which was on the books until President Clinton, working with the Republican Congress, they, by that point in time, thought that that was a policy that was creating more damage than good. It was creating what we refer to as welfare dependency. And so to try to break that cycle of poverty that was unfortunately being enabled by a federal program to get rid of, or at least to help out people who, you know, single moms, it was actually creating a cycle generation to generation of individuals who couldn't get break out of that dependency on federal assistance. at any rate, that was after King was assassinated. But at the time, I think he thought more should be done, and specifically done so that those who were, he believed, still harmed by the legacy of what he referred to as over 300 years of racial enslavement, he thought that those programs really could be targeted to the greatest victims of slavery. And that, of course, in his mind, were descendants of enslaved Black people.
But from your description, it sounds like this modern conservative critique of welfare, that it creates this welfare dependency. It sounds, from your description before, almost like King might have shared similar skepticism in that he wanted families to be self-sufficient, and he wanted people to be out there making a living, getting job training, education, etc. Is that accurate, that he probably also wouldn't have supported kind of blank check type welfare payments that went on and on?
I think the problem here is that King didn't live long enough to see the detrimental effects of the Great Society of Programs. In other words, what's most striking about his claims with respect to what he called Bill of Rights for the Disadvantaged, the most striking claim was that he believed that the effects would be almost immediate. And that, so he was making a claim in terms of human psychology or human nature, in terms of a provision of federal assistance that, at least in time, didn't prove to be true. So it's unclear what exactly he would have called for beyond what was already tried and in some measures failing to actually help the people that it's intended to help. And let me just state something anecdotally here, because I know someone who was on federal assistance because they had a mental condition that disabled them from actually holding a job. And so this was someone who clearly needed assistance of some form, whether from the federal government or state. And this person was on federal aid, but was penalized if she had savings beyond a certain amount. And so she had no incentive to be more efficient than she needed to. So I just, at least personally, have witnessed a situation where a system enabled someone to survive and sustain herself, but it wasn't something that this person was able to move beyond. And I don't know, get back to your question, I don't know what King would have said in the way of a policy change, a change in the Constitution, or a change, as he put it, in our set of values. What values would he have presented to the American people that they didn't already possess that would enable them to create a society that would be more rewarding for everyone?
Right. That's, to me, the most interesting part about this discussion, is that his end goal was really a normative shift, a change in values. And it sounds like not exclusively on the part of African-Americans or other disadvantaged people, but on the part of the whole society, and that should occur quite quickly given a change in people's economic conditions, which I think is just a really interesting idea, that his goal wasn't equality, socioeconomic equality, or elimination of poverty. It sounds like he was interested in that, but only as a means to an end, which is this broader shift in values and this condition of loving one another, which I think is very at odds with our, you know, contemporary, whatever you want to call it, sort of materialist or neoliberal understanding of how markets work and welfare states work.
Yeah, let me add something to that. You just called something to my mind here. Given his Christian thinking about life, one of the hallmarks of the New Testament is a concern for the poor, the least among us. And for King, the problem of poverty in the United States was not simply poverty. It was poverty in the midst of wealth, tremendous wealth. And so for him, he believed that was tremendously dispiriting, not just to poor Blacks, but any poor person in the United States, because it was so easy to see a lot of people who weren't poor. He blamed capitalism for that. He did not like a system that could generate wealth for some people and leave other people out. He did not blame those people. He blamed the system for that result.
Yeah, this discussion has also made me think of some contemporary voices on the right that call themselves common good. They talk about common good capitalism, or they talk about a sort of a national conservatism. And they also, often from a conservative Catholic, so like King, from a religious standpoint, advocating expansion of the welfare state, more protectionism against international trade, and all these things to tamp down inequality, but also to pursue a shift in values, right? The same way that King was advocating. Of course, I think these people are coming from completely different place on the political spectrum and probably would come to very different conclusions about specific policies. But it's interesting that King shares with them this religious Christian concern for poverty and inequality and for the ends of a shift in values, with some contemporary voices on what some people would call pretty far on the right.
All I would add to that, a couple of things. One, even among those, regardless of their political persuasion, who are concerned for, I mean, have a genuine concern for taking care of people who, there, but for the grace of God, go we. The question of means is an important one. So one observation to make here is, well, is the federal government, simply because it's the most power, that's where most of the power and the money is that the best way to accomplish the objective? I know among some Catholics, the idea of subsidiarity is important. In other words, the means by which poor people are taken care of should be done by those who are most familiar with the downtrodden, and that this is something that shouldn't begin from the top and then work its way to the bottom, but rather should begin more locally and then move out in terms of systems and to try to meet that, to alleviate that poverty. And then others who are still, again, genuinely concerned for taking care of the poor believe that this is something that should not happen by way of political action, but through volunteer and charitable networks and organizations. And so it's the call that Jesus has for us to take care of the least. It's a call that's issued to individual persons, not to systems per se or governments. And so they think the more that this is done by anonymous bureaucratic administrations, the least hearts are changed in the process.
Yeah, absolutely. But we have moved pretty far along, and I didn't even ask you about Frederick Douglass. So you said that your lecture was about King's patriotism versus Douglass's patriotism, and you wanted to talk about a little bit, maybe tell us a little bit about how Douglass's patriotism differed from that of King, and maybe I think you said that you even used him as a critique of Martin Luther King.
Yeah, and the way I did it, I mean, given it's a Martin Luther King talk, so I'm not going to just show up and say, here's what I don't like about King. I like a lot of things that King was arguing for. And my implicit argument was that King was most successful, and deservedly so, when he did the things, said the things specifically along the lines of what Frederick Douglass said. We got to remember, Frederick Douglass, even more than King, had every right to hate this country because he was born in slaveholding Maryland. He was enslaved as a baby and chose to attempt to escape and was finally successful when he was about 20. For a while, did not claim America as his country. He couldn't love a country that didn't love him. But he came to see that the key to progress, not just to abolition, but to progress in terms of civil and political rights, would come precisely and ironically by the very country that was robbing him of his agency as a man. He learned from America the very things that could happen in America to solve their own problems, and that he found in the principles of the Declaration, as King did, that he found in the institutions of the Constitution, same thing King did. And so the way I structured my speech was to first talk about Douglass and then pivot to King to show how much King drew from Douglass's own appreciation of the land of his birth. And it was the things that he appreciated in America were precisely the things that pointed out where America was falling short in terms of its practice. Contrary to King, Douglass thought America was sufficient in terms of its principles, founding principles, the ones right at the beginning, written by slaveholding Americans like Thomas Jefferson. Douglass thought that those principles were sufficient, equal protection under the law, sufficient, right? The Constitution amended by the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. If legislation were passed to enforce those amendments, and if the majority white population lived up to their professions, Douglass was satisfied that Black Americans could make as much progress as anybody else. And it really bothered him when any policy or law was made that treated Black Americans as an exception to expectations that were held for everybody else. He thought that reinforced the myth of white supremacy. It undermined our conviction that all men really were created equal and could rise and fall on a level playing field as their own efforts could take them. And so the way I structured my talk was to get into that nitty-gritty of Douglass's arguments and rhetoric, then show how King, at least through the I Have a Dream speech and Letter from Birmingham Jail, among other writings, more or less agreed with Douglass's appeal to America and iconic Americans like Lincoln and Thomas Jefferson. But then King eventually departed from that. He never rejected those principles in his rhetoric, but the things he started emphasizing seemed to be at odds with the sufficiency of those principles for individual improvement.
One thing I wanted to ask you was how experience or study of other countries informed both Douglass and King's view of America and whether it could or could not live up to these ideals. Because I did some brief reading on Frederick Douglass and I learned what I thought was very interesting, that he, I think quite late in his life, was a U.S. ambassador or an emissary to Haiti. I'm not sure whether King traveled widely or studied the politics of other countries, but maybe you could expand on that a little bit about that comparative view of America, right? Because anyone's view of their own country, their own political system is got to be compared to something, right? And it seems that both of these people held America up to its own principles, right? To the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, but perhaps they also were comparing it to the experience of other countries. And I'm wondering whether you might be able to say a few words about that.
I'll treat Douglass briefly on this. I'm not aware that in Douglass's limited travels abroad, he traveled to the United Kingdom when he essentially had to flee from the United States because he was, according to the law, a fugitive slave when he escaped Maryland. And so when he published his autobiography, the first of three autobiographies, within 2 or 3 months, he had to leave the country because his legal owner or master would try to apprehend him and under the law could apprehend Douglass as a fugitive from the labor that he owed. And so he fled for 2 years and was on the speaking tour, gave scores of speeches in England, Ireland, and Scotland. And it was only after his friends, both sides of the pond, paid the £150 sterling that Hugh Auld was owed. He couldn't return to the United States until 1847 when he was legally manumitted. But that, and then being the emissary to Haiti, I'm not aware in my reading of Douglass that he drew any political principles from those travels abroad. Now, in the case of King, he traveled as an adult to major cities of Europe, but most especially to India. It was his travel to India and his readings in Gandhi that led him to not just the principle of civil disobedience and nonviolence, but it was in speaking to, I believe it was Nehru, where King recognized that what India was doing as a country to undo the harm that the caste system had done to what we call the untouchables. It was looking at that and hearing Nehru describe that policy as a policy of atonement, which of course is a Christian term. But Nehru said that, you know, that they had to make up for the harm that the castes had done to these untouchables. And therefore they employed a very explicit quota system, education and in the workplace, to ensure that the untouchables would have a way out of their situation. And King took that to heart, and he actually mentioned it in his 1964 book, Why We Can't Wait. And he refers to that exchange that he had in India as the basis for what we call today reparations. Because slavery had done this harm for so long to Black Americans and the effects of that, what we call today legacy effects, because he believed that Blacks in his time still suffered the effects of slavery, even though they themselves were never enslaved. He thought, or he used that Indian policy as the basis for what I mentioned earlier, which is the Bill of Rights for the Disadvantaged. But he used India and then said, but after all, we've got a fairly recent example ourselves called the GI Bill of Rights. And so it was the combination of what India was doing and the GI Bill of Rights that gave veterans of World War II some advantages, a leg up on the competition, as it were, in terms of finding, you know, getting home loans, jobs, and education. King said, well, hasn't there been a similar deprivation through no fault of their own to Black Americans, and therefore this country has benefited from that unrewarded toil. We should repair that damage through a Bill of Rights for the disadvantaged.
Very interesting, and especially that story about Douglass being in Britain in exile for 2 years is extremely interesting. And even if he may not have written about it, I can only imagine that the experience of having to flee your own country for fear of being re-enslaved and then only being able to buy yourself your own freedom with the support of people from abroad partially, that surely must have had a profound effect on his views about the United States.
Yeah, I should add quickly, he paid not one red cent for his own freedom. He made it clear
that it was others that paid it.
Friends, both American and English or British, that did this. And he had a nice little letter that he published defending, because you know there were some abolitionists who said, Douglas, how are you allowing yourself to be freed in this manner? Aren't you enabling and reinforcing the notion that you could traffic in human beings? And then Douglass explained that it's a subtle argument, but he explained that he, of course, would never pay one red cent for the things that God gave him for free. But it was his friends who did it.
Amazing. Amazing. And it makes it all the more remarkable that he maintained this devotion to the Bill of Rights and the Declaration of Independence and all these other, and the Constitution, in the face of having to live in exile from the United States.
Yeah. If I can add something quickly here, British friends told him, look, send for your family. Don't go back. We love you here. We'll treat you and others who look like you, right? Blacks residing in the United Kingdom. We want you to stay. And he faced that question of whether he should return or stay and adopt England, as he puts it, monarchical England, as he said it in 1847, in a speech called The Right to Criticize American Institutions. This is a speech he gave when he came back. But anyway, he faced that question in a very practical way. And ultimately, he said, you know what? My calling, my vocation is to abolish American slavery. I have that in common with them. I am going to go back and do everything I can. And of course, that was rhetorically through the newspaper, his own newspaper, The North Star, which he co-edited with Martin Delaney, as well as speaking practically every other day on the lecture circuit to abolish slavery and get rid of the color line in America. So he found his calling in America, and that's what led him to go back.
What a remarkable story. So let me then bring this into the present day with, I've got two questions. The first thing I'd like to ask is about how students respond to these sorts of stories today, because I noticed when I was reading about you that you devote a lot of time to teaching and public scholarship. Not only do you teach during your regular duties as a faculty member, but you teach summer schools. You even lead workshops for high school teachers to educate people on these sorts of stories about the American founding, about figures like Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. When you give talks like this and teach people these stories, does it still resonate with Americans today? Does it really inform their view of race relations and the country's political system? Or do you really find it difficult to get the people's attention, given that it's so long ago and so much time has passed?
I have never put on a high school or middle school teacher workshop or taught a class. There's this class I teach in a master's in American history and government class that I've been teaching for a long time over the summers. I've never done these seminars or classes or workshops where the conversation was like crickets or just dull, dead. They are fascinated by the actual history of how progress was made in this country and how progress was stalled. They are, especially in the case of these middle school and high school teachers, it really rejuvenates them to see how alive this history is. And it reminds them of why they got into their occupation to begin with. So they love it. It's not just reading about patriots like King and Douglass. It's reading about the guys that were getting in their way. It's reading about John Calhoun or Stephen Douglas or Alexander Stevens, you know, the seceders or the, you know, Jefferson Davis, or even going back further, people during the time of the colonial era of America or the early revolution in Republican history. I think what fascinates them is they see this more comprehensive, more capacious account of how we got to where we are today and are encouraged by the fact that we can have a more honest and comprehensive understanding of that period and see that our progress was precisely the product of discussion and debate. It wasn't like all these things just came out of George Washington's head one day and then we just followed suit. These were conversations, debates, arguments, sometimes leading to violence, most tragically the Civil War. But it's by looking at this history and considering the salient voices that weren't always on the same side. It was reading closely, paying attention to the arguments, so reading a lot of speeches and editorials, along with the court cases and the actual laws and executive actions that took place. This is what makes history come alive to these teachers. This isn't nostalgic for them, this isn't just, you know, dry as dust, you know, one damn thing after another, as history is sometimes defined. They relish this and love finding out as much as possible about the past because it's way more interesting than your typical textbook. So they love it. Doesn't matter how old it is.
One of the other most fascinating things I learned about you is that you are serving on the U.S. Semi-Quincentennial Commission. I'm very proud of myself for being able to pronounce that. That is the 250th anniversary of 1776. So on July 4th, 2026, there's going to be a celebration. Could you tell us a little bit about how you got involved on that commission, what your role is? And then I'd really be interested to hear what sort of a view of race relations in America are you hoping to put forward for those celebrations, right? 250 years after the founding, with, as well known, this deep flaw in the American founding, the persistence of slavery. What sort of a vision or view of race relations in this country are you pushing for that celebration to kind of represent?
Yeah, number one, and to avoid having to say semi-quincentennial all the time, we just call it America 250. America 250.
Yes, that's the
website.
That's
what you're going to see.
Yeah.
It's the website. You're going to see the logo, the slogan. It's an America for all Americans. And so number one for us, we're not telling people what to think about our past. But we are saying that whether you want to consider it, and we've actually discussed this, a celebration or a commemoration, I think it's both. There is something about 1776. We believe that every American, regardless of race, sex, original nationality, ethnicity, however you identify yourself, there is something about 1776 that you should be able to find as important and inspiring for the story that you are telling and living out in, it's 2024 now, but in 2026, we believe that is something that can embrace every American. And it's in learning about that past, both the progress and the obstacles along the way, that we think, again, we want people to be honest about. So we want this to be educational, but also we want it to be something that's inspiring to people. And, you know, it's not just our troubled racial past. It's also our relationship with the Native Americans. And so we are having liaisons and many meetings with representatives of Indian tribes and nations. We understand that is a significant aspect of our past, much of it unpleasant, that we have to address as well. And so we're also trying to do this in a decentralized way. So we're superintending this effort to commemorate our nation's birth, but we're also trying to encourage states and Indian tribes and nations to come up with their own commissions, and also the dependencies like Guam, et cetera. We're trying to encourage them to come up with their own commissions and to figure out how they too are connected to what happened, you know, among 3 to 4 million Americans in the mid-1770s. And so our message isn't, you know, read this book and you'll have all the answers as to why America is so important and awesome. Our message is to look back to that time period and see those things that we still call upon today as distinctively American, so that when we use the word right or rights or consent, and fundamentally, at least for me, when we use a word like equality, that we can learn from their understanding of that at the time of the founding generation. We can learn from their conversation, their debate, their arguments about those very concepts. We can see how it produced the politically independent country that was the United States of America at that time, and how that shaped our development and expansion, yes, as a country beyond 13 states to the point we are at today. And in fact, we are hoping we have an outreach as well abroad the same way we did in 1776. We're hoping that in 2026, other countries can see that America has been a force for good in world history as well.
Well, I'm really excited, actually, to see how that all plays itself out. I think it's a great thing that you're involved in. Lucas, I think I would ask you our final question, which we ask all of our guests, which is whether you have a suggestion for our listeners for a podcast or a film or a book or a lecture or anything like that on the topic of civil discourse and debate.
Wow, I could mention a lot because essentially that's what I do for a living, teaching classes on race inequality and political philosophy in my Lincoln statesmanship course. In terms of movies, I'm still surprised to hear from people that say that the movie Glory, for example, which was about the role that Black Americans played in fighting that war to save the Union, that movie came out in 1988, 1989, one of those years. And people did not know that Black Americans actually fought in any American war, let alone the Civil War. And so if you haven't seen the movie Glory, best Civil War movie ever made, and the story that it tells, which is mostly accurate, it is a movie, I think that's one that should inform our civil discourse and debate, but also the Lincoln movie. I'm a Lincoln guy, so I gotta recommend Lincoln. So the Lincoln movie where Daniel Day-Lewis won his third, deservedly, his third Academy Award. Again, there are some historical discrepancies in that movie, but more or less get the character and resolution and principle of Lincoln right. I would direct people's attention to those movies. In terms of things to read, I'm a close reader and teacher of close reading of texts. And so I would say just pick up any book that has the collected speeches and writings of great American thinkers like Frederick Douglass or Abraham Lincoln or George Washington or Jefferson, for that matter. Those are well worth looking at.
Well, thank you very much, Lucas Morrell, for being on the podcast and for visiting us here at Arizona State University.
It was a pleasure being here.